Welcome to Rebel Tales Podcast. This is a quick bonus episode today. I'm going to publish the second episode on Monday, and that's going to be the first part of the series in the Kilmichael Ambush. But today, I didn't want to let the occasion pass without recognising the executions of the leaders of the 1916 Rising 107 years ago, starting on the 3rd of May and ending today. And I just want to, first of all, read their names so that they're in our thoughts. But to start it off with, I want to read the Proclamation of Independence, which is the reason, the bedrock of their beliefs, why they fought and what they were fighting for. They were fighting for a better Ireland, one for all of its citizens. And this is what Padraic Pearse read on the steps of the GPO to a crowd who were jeering him and didn't quite know what to make of this guy in volunteer's uniform and the lads with rifles that were storming the post office behind him. To start it off, Poblacht na hÉireann, the Provisional Government of the Irish Republic, to the people of Ireland. Irish men and Irish women, in the name of God and of the dead generations from which she receives her old tradition of nationhood, Ireland, through us, summons her children to her flag and strikes for her freedom. Having organised and trained her manhood through her secret revolutionary organisation, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, and through her open military organisations, the Irish Volunteers and the Irish Citizen Army, having patiently perfected her discipline, having resolutely waited for the right moment to reveal itself, she now seizes that moment, and supported by her exiled children in America and by gallant allies in Europe, but relying in the first on her own strength, she strikes in full confidence of victory. We declare the right of the people of Ireland to the ownership of Ireland and to the unfettered control of Irish destinies, to be sovereign and indefeasible. The long usurpation of that right by a foreign people and government has not extinguished the right, nor can it ever be extinguished except by the destruction of the Irish people. In every generation, the Irish people have asserted their right to national freedom and sovereignty. 6 times during the past 300 years, they have asserted it in arms. Standing on that fundamental right and again asserting it in arms in the face of the world, we hereby proclaim the Irish Republic as a sovereign, independent state, and we pledge our lives and the lives of our comrades in arms to the cause of its freedom, of its welfare, and of its exaltation among the nations. The Irish Republic is entitled to, and hereby claims, the allegiance of every Irish man and Irish woman. The Republic guarantees religious and civil liberty, equal rights and equal opportunities to all its citizens, and declares its resolve to pursue the happiness and prosperity of the whole nation and of all its parts, cherishing all of the children of the nation equally, and oblivious of the differences carefully fostered by an alien government which have divided a minority from the majority in the past. Until our arms have brought the opportune moment for the establishment of a permanent national government, representatives of the whole people of Ireland and elected by the suffrages of all her men and women, the Provisional Government, hereby constituted, will administer the civil and military affairs of the Republic in trust for the people. We place the cause of the Irish Republic under protection of the Most High God, whose blessing we invoke upon our arms, and we pray that no one who serves that cause will dishonour it by cowardice, inhumanity or rapine. In this supreme hour, the Irish nation must, by its valour and discipline, and by the readiness of its children to sacrifice itself for the common good, prove itself worthy of the august destiny to which it is called. Signed on behalf of the Provisional Government, Thomas J. Clark, Sean McDermida, Padraic Pearse, James Connolly, Tomás McDonagh, Eamon Cant, and Joseph Plunkett. There's so much to unpack in that, and we will in a future episode. But when you think how carefully crafted it is, carefully worded it is, you can see that Pearse the poet and the dreamer had heavy hand in it, but also James Connolly's heavily socialist teachings. But what stands out to me most about this document, this Proclamation of a Republic, is that when these men were writing this and putting it together and printing it in Liberty Hall, which was the headquarters of James Connolly's Irish Citizen Army, the ICA, which were one of the main factions that fought with the Irish Volunteers throughout the Easter Rising, and distributing it and reading it from the steps of the GPO. They also must have known that the chances of them living long enough to build this new Ireland was going to be very slim. The chances of a stray bullet catching them, the chances of them being captured and immediately executed, heading to the gallows to be hung, or getting shot by firing squad, which inevitably happened. There was a good chance that they weren't going to be the ones who were going to lead this country in the formation of a republic. But they lit the spark, and they lit the fuse that led to the formation of Dáil Éireann, that led to the War of Independence. So I want to read the names of the men who were executed between the 3rd of May and the 12th of May. So on the 3rd of May, Patrick Pearse, Tomás McDonagh, and Thomas Clark. On the 4th of May, Joseph Plunkett, William Pearse, who was the brother of Patrick Pearse, Edward Daly, and Michael O'Hanrahan. On the 5th of May, John McBride. On the 8th of May, Eamon Kent, Michael Mallon, Sean Houston, and Con Colbert. And the 12th of May, which is 107 years ago today, James Connolly and Sean McDermott. And James Connolly, who was injured during the fighting, he was executed while sitting in a chair. They all men died by firing squad, and all of their bodies were covered in quicklime and very quickly buried around Kilmainham Jail. There were some whose executions were commuted to life imprisonment, one of those being Eamon de Valera, and the fact that he was born in New York may have saved his life, but also international opinion was quickly turning against the British for these executions. There was also the great Countess Constance Markievicz, whose death sentence for being a leader in the 1916 Rising. She was in Stephen's Green and actually shot a member of the DMP, the Dublin Metropolitan Police, killing him. She was heavily involved in the fighting. When her sentence was commuted, she famously said, "I do wish your lot had the decency to shoot me," which will tell you an awful lot about her mindset. She was a devout Republican until her death in 1927. She wasn't going to settle for anything less than a full Irish Republic. All of the leaders of 16 were court-martialed and sentenced to death. They didn't get an opportunity for a fair trial to fight their case. And some may say, sure, to be honest, they wouldn't have had much of a case to fight, really, would they? They led an open rebellion against the British Empire, who were the rulers of Ireland at that time. They fired guns. People died on both sides. An awful lot of civilians died. So what kind of an argument would they have had to defend themselves? And a few years ago, there was a TV show called The Trial of Padraig Pearse. And Nidge from Love Hate, Tom Von Lawler, actually played Padraig Pearse. And he did a great job, in fairness. But there's actually a fictional speech to the judge in that I want to read, because it's really, really striking and really captures and will help those to understand why these people fought an open rebellion and risked their lives and sacrificed their lives for the sake of an Irish Republic. "Fellow citizens, Irish citizens, I wish to talk to you for a moment about a country with a noble history, a country with an ancient literature, a vibrant culture, a proud country, but a small country, a small island country off the west coast of Europe, a country called Great Britain. Britain is at war, and nobody is certain what the future may hold, but one cannot plan for a future if one cannot imagine it. I ask you here today to consider Britain's future if Germany was to win this great war. Germany, as ruler now, of course, insists its intentions are benevolent. It means only to improve Britain. Germany is proud of its democracy, its rule of law, and its education system, so Britain should be grateful for the improvements it has bought. Germany even allows Britain to elect representatives to the Parliament in Berlin, where they sit in permanent minority, unable to effect any change. German officials control the judicial system, and German money controls the newspapers, all ensuring they reflect proper morality, German morality. British parents find their children coming home talking about what they learned in class, how Germany has rescued England from its backward ways. Thank heavens. They learn only German now, so they can get ahead in the world. English, and with its history, culture, and heritage is a waste of our children's time. Perhaps you can imagine unrest in this future, a revolt against the German occupation. Naturally, Germany speaks of violent radicals that endanger our future. Children are taught to denounce these agitators as traitors. Then, when they come of age, they can be sent to foreign lands to defend Germany's honour and interests on the battlefield. If you can imagine this future, you have already imagined Ireland's past. In that future, who would dare say to an Englishman he has no right to resist foreign rule? And yet, they say it to us here today. Gentlemen, to convict me of treason is to say loudly that we have no such right. Now, that's fictional, but that's incredible when you put it into the perspective of the occupier, of the British Empire, when those who didn't see why Ireland was rising up because they were, Dublin was the second city of the empire, yet they had the poorest tenement slums in Europe in 1915. That didn't make the papers in England. If these people, these leaders of 16, had had that chance to represent themselves in court, to represent themselves at trial, maybe the execution still would have gone ahead. Maybe not for all 16, maybe for just the seven signatories, who knows. But at least this narrative would have got out to the world. It would have probably hit the American papers, the Italian papers, and in some cases the British papers that were more sympathetic to those under the empire's rule. Maybe it would have changed something. Maybe it would have changed public opinion. Maybe that would have been a catalyst for change within the empire that was already in unrest. So because this is only a bonus episode, it's going to stay short. But I want to finish with a reading from a book, a biography of James Connolly by Samuel Levinson. And this is something that stood out to me when I read this as a young fella. Connolly had been a captive for more than a week when Mrs. Connolly was told that she could visit him. On Monday, the 8th of May, she did so, accompanied by her youngest daughter, Fiona. On the following day, she was accompanied by her daughter, Nora. It was immediately after the court-martial, but no decision had been rendered. Connolly, pale and feverish, and talking in a low voice, suggested to his wife that she ask Francis Sheehy Skeffington to collect some of Connolly's proletarian and patriotic ballads and have them published. With difficulty, Lily kept her secret. After extolling the way the insurgent men and women had fought in the rising, he asked Nora whether she had seen any socialist papers. She had not. "They will never understand why I am here," Connolly remarked. "They all forget that I am an Irishman." On Wednesday, Brother Aloysius found Connolly exhausted and running at a high fever, but on the next day he was feeling much better. For the first time since leaving Liberty Hall, he had had a natural night's sleep. At 11 p.m. he was awakened with the information that the court-martial had reached a decision. He would be shot at dawn. At midnight, a British officer visited Mrs. Connolly. He said that her husband was very weak and wished to see his wife and eldest daughter, and that an automobile was waiting outside to bring them to the castle. Connolly's head turned as Lily and Nora entered the small hospital room. "Well, Lily, I suppose you know what this means," he said. Lily, kneeling beside his bed, sobbed. "But your beautiful life, James. Your beautiful life." "Hasn't it been a full life, Lily? And isn't this a good end?" Connolly mentioned that he had finally learned of the death of Skeffington, whereupon Nora gave him the names of the others who had died in battle or had been executed. Nora sensed that he was shocked, that he had somehow expected that he would be the first to face the firing squad. Brother Aloysius arrived, heard Connolly's confession, and administered the last rites. He remained at his side when soldiers removed Connolly from his bed, placed him on a stretcher, and drove him in an ambulance to Kilmainham Jail. When the ambulance reached the back entrance to the jail yard, Connolly was lifted out and transferred from his stretcher to a chair. The Capuchin asked, "Will you say a prayer for the men who are about to shoot you?" "I will say a prayer for all brave men who do their duty according to their lights," Connolly replied, gripping the side of the chair to steady himself and holding his head high to await the volley. Dead were buried in quicklime in Arbor Hill Barracks, a place to be commemorated ever since in Irish patriotism. That should have been the end of it. A desperate, scatterbrained attempt had been made to free Ireland, and the rebels had been duly punished. Not counting the 16 executed, only 64 insurgents had been killed. But they had caused the death of 130 military and police, and 260 civilians. Many of these civilians had been victims of their own reckless curiosity. During the week of the rising, local doctors and hospitals tended to some 2,600 injured persons. A large part of the central city had been burned out, with 179 buildings wrecked. Damage was estimated at £2.5 million. Public relief had to be given to 100,000 people, about one-third of Dublin's total population. The great majority of the Irish, and certainly all of the English, were shocked and outraged by the senselessness of the revolt. What happened next was, in the words of Desmond Ryan, one of the most interesting and indubitable examples in all of history of the triumph of failure. During the first days of the rebellion, the Dublers, anticipating that it would be promptly suppressed, casually filed through barricades to buy bread and other groceries, and carried on with their everyday duties. The pubs were closed by government proclamation on Tuesday, but it was not until Thursday that the rebellion became a nuisance. By that time, buses had stopped running, theatres and cinemas were shut, postal services were suspended, and no food could be found in some areas. With banks closed, people ran short of money, and even those who had a few shillings had difficulty in finding stores that had not been sold out or looted. Since few newspapers were being published, rumours ran rife. Connolly was reported dead on four occasions. Some people believed that the Germans had landed in Kerry, others were convinced that the men firing on British soldiers were German, or at the very least in the pay of Germany. Those who had relatives fighting in France or elsewhere for Britain were particularly bitter at this stab in the back. Their numbers can be estimated from the fact that some 150,000 Irish were serving as volunteers with the British Army, another 115,000 were serving in such paramilitary organisations as the Royal Irish Constabulary. In contrast, the number of Irish volunteers was not much more than 10,000, and the Irish Citizen Army was 300 at most. In other words, for every Irish soldier, there were 16 men serving the British. The Irish volunteers were themselves split, as has been described. Half of the headquarters staff, including Owen McNeill, Chief of Staff, opposed the rising. It was planned and conducted by a minority of a minority of the minority. Most of those Irish who had relatives in the British forces still believed in the British promise of home rule after the war was over, and feared that the rising would only serve that Ireland was not ready for this. All sections of the British and Irish establishment, including the press and the hierarchies of the Protestant and Catholic churches, reflected and fanned these sentiments. The newspaper of 8th of May carried a letter from Protestant Archbishop of Dublin calling for stern punishment of the rebel leaders. "This is not the time for amnesties and pardons. It is the time for punishment swift and stern," he wrote. The Roman Catholic bishops, had they not been taken so completely by surprise, would certainly have issued a statement condemning the uprising. As it was, Cardinal Logue telegraphed the Pope, "Insurrection happily terminated," according to Freeman's Journal. The Vatican greatly praised the Irish clergy for the zeal for which they supported government efforts to restore law and order, and the Bishop of Raphoe demanded action against the new paganism of the Huns. On Friday of Easter week, the Cork Examiner attributed the lamentable outbreak to Larkin, Connolly and other syndicalists. William Martin Murphy's Irish Catholic described the rising as criminal and insane. Pierce was as crazy and insolent schoolmaster, and the insurgents as an extraordinary combination of rogues and fools. Murphy's other paper, the Irish Independent, was equally bitter. When a lull occurred in the series of executions before Connolly's turn, it said editorially, "Let the worst of the ringleaders be singled out and dealt with as they deserve." The same issue contained a paragraph of Connolly lying in Dublin Castle. Thanks in part to the conspirators' own passion for secrecy, miscomprehension of global goals characterised all the newspapers. Almost unanimously, they held Sinn Féin responsible. Public bodies in many parts of Ireland joined in the clamour for revenge. The Ballyclare Urban District Council called Pierce and Connolly traitors of the meanest and most cowardly type. NAIS officials dwelt upon the wickedness and the insanity of the rebels. Tralee officials deplored with horror the outbreak, which brings the blush of shame to every honest Irishman. Socialist and Labour leaders were equally unsympathetic. A leader of the Social Democratic Federation, a Swiss named Jenneret, with whom Connolly occasionally stayed during his visits to Edinburgh, wondered how the great socialist agitator could have mixed up with that Sinn Féin business. John Leslie, prostrate with grief, bitterly reproached himself for helping Connolly to settle in Ireland in the first place. An attempt to hold a protest meeting in Birmingham was a complete failure. In the United States, the eminent socialist Victor Berger could not understand why Connolly should go down in a skirmish. The Socialist Labour Party, now more than ever a sect rather than a party, but still vocal, stigmatised Connolly as a convert to the madness of nationalism. The Irish Trade Union Congress and Labour Party, meeting at Sligo in August in 1916, made no protest against the execution of Connolly in Malin. The keynote of Thomas Johnson's presidential address was that this is not the place to enter into a discussion as to the right or wrong, the wisdom or the folly of the revolt. The delegates with fine impartiality stood in tribute to the memory of both those who fell on the Rising and those who died on the European battlefields. Though the delegates did not seem to know it, the tide was already turning. The bloodthirsty traitors were already becoming martyred patriots. The patriotism, which had not been kindled by the Rising, was lit by the successive executions of the rebel leaders, by the mass arrests of many persons guilty of nothing but mild nationalist sentiments, by the harsh attitude of British soldiers towards their prisoners and the general populace, and by the realisation that hundreds of badly armed men had waged a gallant struggle for Irish freedom against tremendous odds. The shift in public opinion came with astonishing speed. The first voice raised in protest was that of George Bernard Shaw. In a letter published in the Daily News of London 2 days before Connolly was executed, he said that he could not regard as a traitor any Irishman taken in a fight for Irish independence against the British government, which was a fair fight in everything except the enormous odds my countrymen had to face. He asserted with confidence that time has proved valid. It is absolutely impossible to slaughter a man in this position without making him a martyr and a hero. The shot Irishmen will now take their place beside Emmet and the Manchester martyrs in Ireland, and nothing in heaven or on earth can prevent it. The same prediction, as well as an interesting estimate of Connolly, was made in a letter written in May by George Russell to Sir Matthew Nathan, Under Secretary of Ireland. "I am very sad over Ireland now. I knew many of those dead and had a genuine liking for them. They had no intellect. Connolly was the only one with a real grip in his mind. They were rather feather-brained idealists. And now they will be national heroes. If I remember Connolly was in the Council of the Irish Volunteers, I would have been frightened." And it goes on, and I'm going to cover that in future podcasts from many different sources about how the tide turned and how those rebels became martyrs and fanned the flames that led to the foundation of Dáil Éireann and then into the War of Independence. Even though Connolly was born in Edinburgh in 1868, his parents were Irish, both of them, and I read something about him, and it was very well put. It's that if a cat had kittens in the oven, you wouldn't call them cakes. So James Connolly was very much an Irishman from the start to the end. I'll be back on Monday with the first part of a two-part series on the Carmichael ambush. So until then, thank you for listening to another episode of Rebel Tales.